And that was Ingrid Michaelson with Do It Right Now. And before that was Florence and the Machine with Never Let Me Go. Well, I'm coming to about the end of my program here. But hey, you can always check out whatpinksoundslike.com. That's my blog for the show and my blog for my rants and raves as well. So check that out there. I'll put up there the playlist, the podcast, and also that information that Dulcinea sent to me. So thank you so much, Dulcinea, for doing that. And just let you know, all day we're having women's programming, women's focus, women's centered programming right here on CITR in order to celebrate International Women's Day. Next, don't go anywhere. From 11 a.m. to noon, Rosemary shares eclectic reflections on International Women's Day. There's an interview with Natalie Hill. Natalie will be speaking at a panel at UBC today, March 8th. The panel will showcase a variety of speakers to address their own research on women's rights, lives, and experiences as a way to then talk about the problems and advantages International Women's Day has in its current construction. And that panel discussion day is from 1 to 2:30 p.m. If you are on campus, it's featuring Dr. Anna Karastathis, Dr. Benita Bunjun, Dr. In-Young Choi, Manuela Val, and Natalie Hill. And I apologize if I butchered any of those names. It's in Jack Bell, room 028, lower level, 2080 West Mall at UBC, and it's sponsored by Center for Women's and Gender Studies Graduate Student Association right here at UBC. So stay tuned for that, but I'll leave you with the song before I go. Here's Kathleen Edwards off her latest album, Voyager. And this is Chameleon Comedian. I'll see you next week.
You're a comedian. You hide behind your funny face. Every time. Out of the shadows, out of the cameras and the lights, you're a chameleon. On your darker side, every time, I don't need a punchline. I don't need a punchline. Everybody's watching.
You are listening to CITR 101.9 FM.
Hello and welcome. It's Thursday, March the 8th, 2012, and today is International Women's Day. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM, also on the interweb at citr.ca. My name is Rosemary Anderson, and I'm your host for the next hour. With me in the studio today is Natalie Hill. Natalie is an MA student at UBC's Center for Women and Gender Studies. Natalie holds a degree in journalism and communication from Carleton University. While receiving a practical education in reporting, Natalie's undergraduate studies also included training in critical media analysis, with a focus on semiotics and critical discourse analysis. Natalie's research interests include the representation of women in mainstream and alternative media, reportage, and popular discourse about violence against women, citizen journalism, and digital media. Natalie is on the organizing committee of WAM, which stands for Vancouver Women, Action, and the Media, and she focuses on helping feminist organizations harness the media for social change. Welcome, Natalie.
Thank you for having me.
Natalie's here to talk to us about International Women's Day, which we're celebrating today. And one of the things, Natalie, that I've noticed is that some countries celebrate International Women's Day instead of Mother's Day. Mother's Day, I thought, was supposed to just celebrate women. And I found out that they have a very common history. So, tell me what you can tell me about the history of International Women's Day and how you have become involved in it at this point.
Sure. Well, I'll just give a sort of brief overview of how I see International Women's Day as being operative historically and now. Women have used International Women's Day to celebrate the successes and the gains that they've made through their activism and through their organizing towards equal rights, if you want to put it that way. And of course, these issues range regionally. So in a place like Canada or in the U.S., the origins of International Women's Day had a lot to do with suffrage, full rights and recognition of women as full persons, which sounds ridiculous, but of course was very much the case. But in other regions, it focuses more on access to childcare, freedom from domestic violence, access to education and literacy, access to sustainable agricultural practices. And of course, many of these things, these issues traverse the entire globe. We can see them playing out in different regions, but they're focused on more so in different parts of the world. But at the same time that International Women's Day has been used as a celebratory day, it's also been a rallying point for women and for feminists and for activists to say, look at all that we've accomplished, and yet look at how far we still have to come. So it's been crucial for women to use something like an annual day, which tends to get media press and just general discourse and popular culture about women's rights, which unfortunately isn't in much of the popular discourse for the other 364 days of the year, to use that day as a platform to put forth arguments for continued social change and to right the wrongs that have yet to be addressed. So that's sort of a balance there between celebrating what's been accomplished and also capturing the attention of society who may assume that equality has been achieved or that women are liberated and that feminism is no longer relevant.
So what sort of forms do you see these different celebrations taking? I know that you're involved in something that's happening this afternoon on campus, and I'm sure that there are many ways that that is being celebrated around the city. What are some of the things that people can opt into today if they're interested.
Yeah, it's really interesting because this year is the 101st anniversary of International Women's Day. Last year was the 100th anniversary, which got tons of press. There was a lot of funding from private entities, but also from, in some cases, the state, grants, for example, to put on events to celebrate International Women's Day. We tend to lobby around these big anniversaries. So when it's 100 or when it's 25 or when it's 150, all of a sudden it carries a stronger weight. So last year there was a parade that went through Vancouver, which many cities still do every single year. I know a woman that I know recently mentioned that in Montreal, her hometown, there's a parade every single year for International Women's Day. It's not the case in Vancouver that I know of. I know that there was one last year, but there certainly isn't one. They're hosting documentary screenings. Amnesty has a flash mob that they're organizing today at 11:55 is when it kicks off at the steps of the Vancouver Art Gallery on the Robson Street side, which would be really fun to go see and participate in. And of course, there are always academic events. So here at UBC today, we're hosting a panel on deconstructing and decolonizing International Women's Day, which is going to be really interesting, something I'm going to be participating in, and that's going to be in the basement of the Jack Bell building on campus starts at 12:30 with lunch, and then it kicks off at 1 o'clock is the panel, 1 to 2:30, and that's in room 28 in the lower level of the Jack Bell building. And of course SFU is hosting their own events as well, some public talks and that kind of thing, all from an academic sort of framing of feminist analysis of International Women's Day. But surprisingly, there isn't a lot to going on this year for International Women's Day that I can see, at least in terms of events that are accessible, open to all kinds of different women, meant to simply celebrate and reignite activist fires for that purpose alone. I'm not seeing much of that, and so I think it does say something about the difference between last year and this, and also a few other things about funding for international women's organizations, which we can get into if you want.
I'd love to hear more.
So I would say that in the past, while International Women's Day has been used, as I said before, as this celebration and at the same time simultaneously a point to rally around, in recent decades with the dramatic decreasing in some cases of funding by the state, both the provincial government and the federal government, to women's organizations, which have traditionally emerged out of specific programs and commissions even towards the status of women and promoting the status of women in Canada. With the state reducing the funding to these organizations, International Women's Day has turned into primarily a fundraising event. Which is problematic in that it obviously takes away from the political aspects of the day. Not to say that you can't have a political fundraiser. But what I'm seeing this year when I was looking at the list of events available to me was, kind of a smattering of events that were $60 a plate dinners. You pay a lot of money to have breakfast at the Fairmont or Four Seasons Hotel in Vancouver to hear a guest speaker, and the West Coast Leaf Society, which hosts that breakfast, has done it for 25 years now, and it's a wonderful organization that does great work, but unfortunately that's not the kind of event that a lot of people will be able to go to. Same thing for other organizations that use International Women's Day to host silent auctions or to do artistic productions that are intended to raise money for their women's shelter, for example. I mean, these are organizations that need this money. They're so deserving of this funding, and I absolutely support them in their endeavors for their ingenious tying of their fundraising to International Women's Day, which they know gets a lot of attention and will help fund the work that they do for the rest of the year. I don't discount that at all, but it does speak, I think, to a shift in how our governments in Canada, provincial and federal, view and value or not, as I would argue, the work that these organizations are doing. One of the events that I know is happening today is a graduation ceremony for an organization called Success. And this is an organization that I was introduced to last summer through a short a short job that I did. And Success is a province-wide program that bridges employment for certain populations. So you have immigrants seeking aid in finding employment in BC, people of First Nations heritage, youth, and one of their unique and very valuable programs was for women who fled violent relationships. So women, for example, who are living in transition houses, who are in the process of getting back on their feet, if you will, looking for work, Success offered this specialized program for them. It was private. It was a secure location, which is very important for these women, and a sort of anonymous location where they could go and not just learn how to do their resume, but receive a holistic approach to rebuilding their self-esteem, learning how to re-enter the workforce, how to juggle their responsibilities between work and their children, all of these things. It was a great program. And just this past year, Success and many of their specialty shops, if you will, have lost all of their funding from the provincial government. So they're closing down. And there's a move to sort of Walmart ties the system into a one-stop shop. So all of these unique groups that have been receiving specialized care and programming are now being forced into a one-stop shop where everyone will go and receive a service that is being billed as it's fee-for-service. So as quickly as you can get people in and out in a day is to the benefit of the people providing the service. So that's just one example of an organization that's basically had the wind knocked out of it. And today, their event that they're holding, their graduation ceremony in Burnaby, which honors the successes that the women in their recent program have made, is probably the last one they'll ever have. That's quite sad, if you ask me. And I think really is symbolic of what's going on in 2012 and has been going on in recent years in terms of state, in terms of how the state values programs and services and organizations like these whose sole purpose is for the betterment and well-being of women and women's lives.
Yeah, it doesn't speak very well to our government's support of women and the many, many needs that have been publicized. I mean, we've heard so much, for example, really high profile, the women in the downtown east side. And you're telling me about another organization there that the funding's been withdrawn from.
Yeah, Piers. Piers was a center similar to the Success. It was an employment center on paper, if you will, that helped women transition an exit out of prostitution and into what we might think of more traditional work environments. However, as you can imagine, that process is very delicate, very complex. These women have been through, as you can imagine, quite a lot. And again, you can't just expect a woman who's in the process of trying to exit prostitution, perhaps having been in it for a decade or more, to show up for a resume workshop and expect that that's going to help her transition into this workforce. There's so much more going on, so much more care that needs to happen. And Piers was unique in that former sex workers were leading the charge there and did an excellent job in helping these women. So again, another organization that's completely been deflated, lost all of its funding, and it closed its doors. So that's not a place we can go to today to celebrate International Women's Day.
That's very sad. You've touched on the funding being withdrawn from the from various organizations, and I wonder, are we seeing that being reallocated anywhere other than the one-stop shop that you've kind of described?
That's a good question. Where is the money going? I think that it varies. Obviously, our provincial government has different priorities and constraints compared to the federal government, but obviously, there are similarities between the two, and in terms of there are similarities in terms of their complete devaluing of the importance of these kinds of social services in our society. I mean, you have in the province of BC, one cannot ignore the fact that we have an absolutely gargantuan bill to pay from the 2010 Vancouver Winter Olympics. It's not as simple as saying, oh, the funds were cut from these organizations and now they're going directly to pay for, you know, security on this day during the Olympics. It's not that simple, I understand. But these are the kinds of decisions that our government has made. And now we're having to deal with the consequences. And women in BC, women living in poverty, single mothers, Aboriginal women, women largely disadvantaged in so many ways, are having to pay the price.
Another thing you mentioned is that in other cities, and you gave the example of Montreal, they have a parade, they have many celebrations for International Women's Day itself. And aside from withdrawing the funding for so many organizations, it still surprises me. Is it not a separate thing that we're having much less in the way of celebration, or is that, do you think, integrally tied in to the funding shortage? Why Vancouver? Why is Vancouver not celebrating as much as, for example, Montreal?
Well, I think Vancouver is an interesting case because there are so many incredible feminist activists in Vancouver who are doing great work, and they do it every day. So I know for a lot of women, you might think of, for example, Aboriginal women who have been so vocal and active in response to the missing and murdered women inquiry that's been ongoing in regards to their activism. That's not something they need International Women's Day to rally around. Right. These issues are so close to home. Their voices are integral to this conversation and unfortunately have been shut out, again, due to a lack of funding for legal representation for the organizations and for the family members who so urgently were needed at that discussion and who have been excluded. But that's the point I'm getting at, is that in Vancouver, you might say that there are groups who might even dismiss something like International Women's Day with its history and its historical references to certain subsets of women and women's rights that don't necessarily speak to them. Obviously, I'm not a woman of color, and I cannot speak for these women or for Aboriginal women. But I suspect that some women might have criticisms in that regard, and rightfully so. But I think it's important to see the work that these women are doing throughout all 365 or 66 in this case in 2012 days of the year, not just what they're doing today.
Okay. This afternoon, beginning at 1 o'clock until 2:30, you're taking part in a panel discussion that is addressing research on women's rights and lives and experiences. And I understand that you're going to be talking about the problems and advantages that International Women's Day has in its current construction. Now, are there things that you're going to be saying there that are quite different from what you're talking about here? Decolonizing and deconstructing International Women's Day is your topic. What exactly does that mean?
Good question. There's going to be multiple speakers who will interpret this question and this topic differently. So I'm curious even myself to see what direction they're going to go with it. For me personally, I'm going to be speaking to the research that I've been doing for the past couple of years related to discourses in alternative online media. And by that, I mean blogs and feminist online news reporting, which we might see as alternative to traditional newspaper or mainstream TV radio journalism. So I've been focusing on these types of media and how they have constructed rape in the Democratic Republic of Congo. And one thing that I've found is that in some cases, seemingly well-meaning journalists or bloggers out to expose, if you will, what they see as a tragedy going on in Central Africa end up reproducing what we might describe as colonial discourses or neo-colonial fantasies about the women of the DRC. So that's what I'm going to be talking about today, is how people women and men who aim to be advancing a sort of humanitarian, in some cases, perspective or analysis of an issue, in some ways harm the very people they purport to be helping through the imagery that they employ, through the journalistic strategies that they use, and how this is problematic, and it can't be just taken on its surface as being on its surface as being, for example, good journalism or for the benefit of women or in the service of, in my case, the women of the Congo.
Can you give a specific example, or is that too much of a sneak preview?
Sure. So I analyzed specifically two different websites, and this was for my master's paper, which I completed last year, and I focused on an organization called Women's E-News. Now, Women's E-News emerged because women in the field of journalism felt that quote-unquote women's stories were not being told, or that the news wasn't serving women. So that was the basis for the organization, and they ended up doing a series on sexual violence in the Congo, which I analyzed, and I found that there was a pattern of the journalists employing a metaphor for the war, and employing bodily imagery. So instead of referring to women as persons, as full independent and full independent persons with agency and with histories and with politics, women were referred to as body parts. So instead of a description of what a woman had gone through, we would get a very graphic clinical description of how her body had been mangled by an act of rape, or how she is basically come to embody the injury that she now sustains, which is, for example, a fistula, related to very graphic acts of rape and sodomy. So in that case, you have to ask yourself, are the women of the Congo being served by this discourse, which in many ways is very dehumanizing and degrading? Mind you, there's lots of factors at play here. We can't necessarily overlook issues like language and translation, and how it's very difficult to get full pictures from people that we're interviewing as journalists if we're not speaking the same language. It's kind of a primary barrier there. And also issues of anonymity. These are survivors of rape and extreme sexual violence. It's not always in their best interests, or it's not always ethical to paint a very full picture of who they are, quite literally, just for safety and security reasons. So you can't overlook these issues. But I do believe that the alternative is not necessarily this very graphic, dehumanizing imagery that I found in these stories. So that's what I'll be talking about a little bit today.
That's very interesting. One of the things that I'm very curious about is what made you choose to study DR Congo, and why you chose only the DR Congo and not a selection of perhaps African countries.
Yeah, that's a question that I still ask myself. I'm not entirely sure, and it's one that is related, of course, to ethics. Given my social location and who I am, and the issues related to someone like me studying, if you will, this situation, reading and writing about women that I will never meet, and about a location and a part of the world where I have never been, is very problematic, absolutely. And these are issues that I grapple with all the time. But I think the motivation just came out of a sense of disbelief. I when I started reading about what women had experienced in the Congo, I literally could not believe this was true. I could not believe that this was happening. And even though I have become completely desensitized to many images and reports of violence and sexual violence, and it's almost come to be torture as usual, as it occurs in the world every day, there was something about the reporting that I originally read that really grabbed me, and I just couldn't sleep. I just couldn't sleep at night. It really affected me. And from there, I sort of developed to become something that I could see as being applicable to my experiences in journalism and my interest in ethics and journalism. And so that's where my research focus emerged eventually, away from this sort of guilty humanitarian, Western humanitarian, African victim dichotomy that's very problematic, which I have to admit was the seed of it all. I've sort of moved away from that. However, the issues at play in this relationship that I have or don't have with women in the Congo is obviously something that I still must acknowledge and think about all the time.
So, Natalie, we're just going to wrap up this conversation. I want to thank you so much for coming. Do you have any sort of final words that you'd like to put out there?
Well, I would just encourage everyone to have a look at the list of events that are going on today and do try and get out to at least one. There are options, and it's a great day and a great time to connect with other people who are interested in social justice and in advancing women's rights and full participation in our society, both here and around the world. To think critically about the types of events that you can't attend today, maybe because you can't afford it or because they're inaccessible to you. I know students at UBC tend to have a lot of privilege and a lot of mobility and can move around, but there are a lot of people in Vancouver and in our community who aren't necessarily included in the events that go on a day like today. So to think about that and to think about how we might create safer spaces for International Women's Day, more inclusive spaces for International Women's Day that truly invite all to participate and not just the usual suspects.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. My pleasure.
You've been listening to an interview with Natalie Hill, a graduate student at UBC's Center for Women's and Gender Studies. Natalie will be participating in a panel discussion addressing women's rights, lives, and experiences. That starts at 1 p.m. today in the Jack Bell Building at UBC, the lower level of the Jack Bell Building, room 28.
I am woman, hear me roar, in numbers too big to ignore, and I know too much to go back and pretend. I've heard it all before, and I've been down there on the floor. No one's ever gonna keep me down again. Oh, yes, I am wise. What is wisdom for the pain? Yes, I pay the price. But look how much I gained. If I have to, I can do anything. I am strong.
In addition to the events around and about town today, International Women's Day is being celebrated on Saturday. The BC of Federation of Labour and the Vancouver District Labour Council are inviting women and their families to a family-friendly celebration of the 101st International Women's Day. And it's free to attend. It's at the W2 Atrium at 111 West Hastings Street in Vancouver. And they say that it'll be packed with information tables and face painters and performers and lots more. In addition, there will be films by and about women shown. Possible films include the National Film Board classics Not a Love Story, the first major expose of the porn industry, and The Company of Strangers, which is about a group of elderly women who share life stories while awaiting a ride after their bus breaks down. Again, that's on Saturday, March the 10th, from 2 to 5 at the W2 Atrium. If you're on campus right now, you might be interested in joining in the panel that Natalie Hill is taking part in the Jack Bell room. That's from 1 o'clock until 2:30. If you're not, or if you're heading downtown at 11:55 today, there is the Freeze Flash Mob. Amnesty International is holding the Freeze Flash Mob to create awareness that women's rights are human rights that need to be on the daily agenda everywhere. They ask that you wear purple clothing if you can, or any kind of purple accessories, and that you grab a newspaper. At 12 o'clock, everyone will freeze while pretending to read the paper. Then 4 minutes later, the flash mob will end as usual, and people will go about their day.
There are 7.3 billion people in the world.
Roughly half of these people are women.
It is believed that 59% of these women will have experienced some kind of violence during their life.
This violence came from spouses, family members, or warring people.
But it was and will not be limited only to physical abuse.
22% of those victims would be under the age of 12.
An estimated 1 million children, most of which are girls, are forced to enter the sex trade.
Violence against women happens in every country. Many of these women won't or can't come forward. They're not equal simply because they're women.
And being born a woman can be fatal. 60 million girls are missing in the world due to sex-selective abortions, infanticide, and neglect.
But women around the world are neglected every day by being denied education.
There are roughly 774 million illiterate adults in the world, roughly two-thirds of which are women and have been for the past 20 years.
And out of the 72 million children who are not attending elementary school, 54% of them are girls.
In less developed regions, 45% of women will not complete a secondary education.
And only 15% of women with a secondary education will be allowed a tertiary education.
In lesser developed regions, this number will plummet to almost zero.
For women around the world are being denied an education. It is no surprise that they are at a higher risk for employment vulnerability.
80% of the women in Eastern and Western Africa are categorized as high risk for employment vulnerability.
75% of women in Southern Asia suffer the same fate.
35% of women in South America.
15% in Southern Europe and 10% in Northern Europe.
10% is too much. Are their jobs more at risk due to their domestic work?
On average, women spend twice as many hours as men doing domestic work in the home.
From the average extra 4 hours that women in Africa work in the home to the 6 hours that Latin American women work, jobs of women around the world are suffering drastically due to this simple fact.
No woman should have to suffer through these inequalities.
Improving the lives of women improves the quality of life for everyone.
Gender equality raises the cause of child survival, societal development, and alleviate poverty throughout the world.
A stand taken for women's rights
is human's right.
The United Nations Millennium Project aims for gender equality and empowered women by 2015.
If these goals are achieved, child mortality, maternal health,
educational needs,
and poverty can all be improved drastically.
What you've seen are the most recent statistics.
They are numbers representing real women who've suffered through real injustice.
But numbers can change.
In 10 years, will so many women still be suffering?
Or will the global community set their sights on improving women's and therefore humans' rights?
And you can help stop this injustice.
By seeing this, by sitting where you are, by feeling what you feel.
You've already taken the first step.
The final blow hits you. Somebody else gets what you wanted again.
It would be interesting to have a little bit of a history of International Women's Day. It's celebrated in many countries around the world. It's a day when women are recognized for their achievements without regard to divisions, whether national, ethnic, linguistic, cultural, economic, or political. It's meant to be an occasion for looking back on past struggles and accomplishments, and more importantly, it's an occasion to look ahead to the untapped potential and the opportunities that await future generations of women. International Women's Day first emerged from the activities of labor movements at the turn of the 20th century in North America and across Europe. In 1910, there was a meeting in Copenhagen of the Socialist International, and they established a Women's Day that was to be international in character, to honor the movement for women's rights, and to build support for achieving universal suffrage of women, for women. The proposal was greeted with unanimous approval by the conference, which had over 100 women attendees from 17 countries. And that conference included the first three women elected to the Finnish Parliament. But they hadn't selected a date for the observance. They just decided they would do it. But in 1911, as a result of this Copenhagen initiative, International Women's Day was marked for the first time on the 19th of March in Austria, Denmark, Germany, and Switzerland, where more than 1 million women and men attended rallies. In addition to the right to vote and to hold public office, they demanded women's rights to work, to vocational training, and to an end to discrimination on the job. Since those early years, International Women's Day has assumed a new global dimension for women in developed and developing countries alike. The growing international women's movement, which has been strengthened by four global United Nations women's conferences, has helped make the commemoration a rallying point to build support for women's rights and participation in the political and economic arenas. Increasingly, International Women's Day is a time to reflect on progress made, to call for change, and to celebrate acts of courage and determination by ordinary women who have played an extraordinary role in the history of their countries and communities. The Charter of the United Nations, signed in 1945, was the first international agreement to affirm the principle of equality between women and men. And over the years, the United Nations and its technical agencies have promoted the participation of women as equal partners with men in achieving sustainable development, peace, security, and full respect for human rights. The empowerment of women continues to be a central feature of the UN's efforts to address social, economic, and political challenges across the globe. Now for something in a lighter vein, I've done a little digging and come up with a few gems. First off, the Good Wife Training Manual.
Your goal is to try to make sure your home is a place of peace, order, and tranquility, where your husband can renew himself in body and spirit. Prepare yourself. Take 15 minutes to rest so you'll be refreshed when he arrives. Touch up your makeup. Put something decorative in your hair, like a ribbon or a flower. Be happy to see him. Greet him with a warm smile and show sincerity in your desire to please him. Speak in a low, soothing, and pleasant voice. Make the evening his. Never complain if he comes home late or goes out to dinner without you. Instead, try to understand his world of strain and pressure and his need to relax. Don't ask questions about his actions or question his judgment or integrity. Remember, he is the master of the house and as such will always exercise his will with fairness and truthfulness. You have no right to question him. Listen to him. You may have a dozen important things to tell him, but the moment of his arrival is not the time. Let him talk first. Remember, his topics of conversation are more important than yours. Remember, a good wife always knows her place.
Arise, ye works from your slumbers. Arise, ye prisoners of want. For reason and revolt now thunders, and at last ends the age of cant. Away with all your superstition, servile masses, arise, arise. We'll change henceforth the old tradition, we'll spurn the dust to win the prize. Ah, so comrades, come rally, and the last fight let us best. The Internationale unites the human race. As our comrades come rally, and the last fight let us face. The Internationale unites the human race. No more deluded by reaction, on tyrants only we'll make war. The soldiers too will take strike action. They'll break ranks, they'll fight no more. And if those cannibals keep trying to sacrifice us to the pride, they soon shall hear the bullets flying. We'll shoot the generals on our own side. As our comrades come rally, and the last fight let us face. The Internationale unites the human race. As our comrades come rally, and the last fight let us face. The Internationale unites the human race. No savior from on high delivers. No faith have we in Prince of Peace. Our own right hand the chains must shiver. Chains of hatred, greed and fear. There the thieves will out with their booty and give to all a happier lot. Each at the forge must do their duty and will strike while the iron is hot. As our comrades come rally, and the last fight let us face. The Internationale unites the human race. As our comrades come rally, and the last fight let us face. The Internationale unites the human race. The Internationale
internationally unites the human race.
We have a trilogy of humorous pieces for you. And the second one is Women Know Your Limits with Harry Enfield.
An ordinary dinner party, the sort of occasion we all enjoy. The men are exchanging witty stories. And look at the women, aren't they pretty? Look at the way they laugh, they're delightful. But now the conversation turns to more serious matters.